Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Research shows mountaintop removal mining does impact fish populations.
So we saw about half the number of species that we would expect to find downstream of mountaintop mining operations.
Southwestern Virginia is trying to boost its economy using culture and nature.
We're creating economic opportunity while valuing and wanting to protect the assets we have.
Appalachian food is the topic of a summit in Kentucky.
The goals are simple: grow more of your own food, and then sell your own food.
And a new play delves into the issue of sexual assault in the military.
There's a line in the play that says, "Why am I a hero if I die and a nuisance if I live?"
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Mountaintop removal mining does have an effect on fish populations downstream from the mining operations, according to a study just released by the U.S. Geological Survey. The study title is a mouthful: Temporal Changes in Taxonomic and Functional Diversity of Fish Assemblages Downstream from Mountaintop Mining, which is a fancy way of saying USGS scientists looked at how well fish populations are doing in streams downriver from mountaintop mining sites. The co-authors are Doug Chambers, who's a biologist and water quality specialist in Charleston, and Than Hitt, a researcher at the Leetown Science Center in Jefferson County, West Virginia.
So we were interested in how things are changing with respect to the numbers of species we find and the numbers of fish we find, as well as how they make a living. What are their behavioral traits? What are their feeding traits? What strategies do they use to survive?
Well, we also, over the overall study, looked at such things as the physical habitat in the stream and some water quality characteristics.
Over a two-year period of time, in 2010 and 2011, Chambers and Hitt collected samples from the Guyandotte River Basin in southern West Virginia. Hitt says they were able to compare their samples to data collected in 1999 and 2001 for a water quality study done by Penn State University researchers.
So we were able to ask, how have things changed over time?
The streams in the study contain 25 species of fish that are generally found in an Appalachian stream, including creek chub, minnows, sunfish, and darters. But Hitt says the study shows mountaintop removal mining definitely impacts the fish.
So we saw about half the number of species that we would expect to find downstream of mountaintop mining operations, and we also saw a significant reduction in the total number of fish. But not all fish species are doing poorly in those areas. A minority of species can do quite well.
Chambers says there are many changes to the landscape through the mountaintop mining process, including the way water flows and how it transports minerals, chemicals, and food items.
When you look at a mountaintop removal job, you're taking a pretty massive block of rock, breaking it up into smaller fractions, and then moving some of that to the valley fills. So you've increased the opportunity for contact between the minerals and the rock and the water.
The water below valley fills contains higher concentrations of selenium, an essential nutrient that can be harmful when too much is consumed.
And selenium can influence their ability to produce viable offspring.
The study also shows how well the fish survive changes in water quality depends on what they eat. Hitt says the fish with more diverse diets do better.
The fish species that were most likely to be lost from the system over time were the ones that focused on invertebrates in the stream only. Their diets were limited in that regard.
Hitt and Chambers say the streams used in the study are not popular for recreational fishing, but the results could have implications for bodies of water that are, like the Mud River Reservoir just downstream from the study site. And Chambers says the results can help policymakers as they decide how to regulate the state's water resources.
You know, West Virginia right now is blessed with abundant water. Oftentimes, the problem is too much rather than not enough. Well, we need to understand the quality of this water. You know, if we're going to continue to have readily available, abundant water, we need to understand the processes that affect its quality very broadly.
Both scientists say the study also provides a framework for future research, both in the field and in a lab setting. Biologist Than Hitt works at the USGS Leetown Science Center in Jefferson County, West Virginia, where scientists explore everything from declining fish and mussel populations to the increasing presence of intersex fish in the nation's waterways. Hitt has just started a new research project trying to determine how climate change might affect the brook trout, which is native to Appalachia.
Yeah, you can tell they're brook trout because they have a really interesting kind of wavy pattern on their backs, and the fins have a white and black line on their leading edge. It's very characteristic markings for brook trout. But it's important that people understand, you know, brook trout are the native mountain trout in the Appalachians. These trout were here since, you know, for over the course of multiple glaciation events. They've been here, and they've adapted to cold water streams that, quite frankly, are jeopardized by the change in climate that we expect over the next 30 to 50 years. So the southern Appalachian brook trout can be a canary in the coal mine for us to understand how streams are responding to climate change. This is the experimental stream lab at the Leetown Science Center in Kearneysville, West Virginia. And what we're looking at here is a series of riffle and pool chambers that we've assembled to mimic what headwater streams do. These are cold in temperature. They support brook trout right now. And we're starting with some experimental work to understand how brook trout are going to be changing as air temperature increases. We want to understand what the relative importance of thermal stress is in interactions with other stressors, like changes in invasive species showing up, or changes in prey availability, or other factors that we can control.
There are 12 large round blue tanks in this lab, four sets of three connected tanks so the fish can travel from one to another. It's basically a room full of giant aquariums set up so Hitt can control things like temperature, water chemistry, flow rate, and food supply during the two-month study.
We're looking at a number of different response variables. We're looking at how fish behave with respect to their sort of aggression towards one another. Are they getting really feisty? We're looking at how they distribute themselves across the series of riffles and pools. We're looking at how their blood chemistry changes. So we're looking at the number of red blood cells. We're looking at cortisol and glucose levels in blood plasma. And these are indicators of physiological stress in these fish.
The first invasive species these brook trout will encounter is the brown trout, which is native to Germany.
Brown trout are a prized game fish in some places, and they also are known for displacing native brook trout. It's not clear, though, how that displacement effect interacts with the temperature effect. In warming streams, maybe that's where brown trout are able to displace brook trout fully, whereas in the colder streams, perhaps they're able to coexist and persist in the same stream reach.
Aside from conducting controlled experiments in these tanks at the lab in Leetown, Hitt will do field work at the Shenandoah National Park and the Delaware Gap National Recreation Area. Partners in the project include the USGS Chesapeake Bay Program, the National Park Service, and some state divisions of natural resources. The deteriorating natural environment in Appalachia, which endangers the brook trout and other creatures and habitat in the region, is also a concern for 85-year-old Ronald Micklem. On Monday afternoon, he and two other men began an open-ended fast inside the West Virginia Capitol building. Roxy Todd talked with Micklem as he was just finishing his first day without food.
Inside the West Virginia Capitol building, Roland Micklem sits on a marble bench, holding in one hand a handmade wooden cane, and in the other hand a small poster that tells why he is fasting. Micklem is here on an extended fast, consuming only water, coffee, juice, and some medication, in order to raise awareness for the various causes of climate change, which he says include mountaintop removal mining.
I don't like to call it protest, but it is a witness, and it is an expression of my genuine grief for the loss of creation.
Micklem is an 85-year-old Army veteran, an environmental writer, and a retired science teacher. At the Capitol building today, he is joined by activists Vincent Irene and Mike Rizel, who are also taking part in this fast. Micklem asked them to help plan this fast, which could go on for days or weeks.
I'm quite willing to fast here until I can't do it anymore or until I die.
Micklem grew up in Virginia in the 1930s. Watching the diversity of plants and animals disappear in Appalachia is what has led him to become an activist.
Take over of our countryside, as it were, by commercial interests has just destroyed so many of what were once, I call them cherished friends, birds and animals that I learned about when I was young. That kind of turned me into an activist.
The activism Micklem believes in is nonviolent civil disobedience.
That has to be led properly. It has to be conducted with people who have love in their hearts and absolutely no animosity towards the people who will oppose them.
At the end of the first day of their fast, the Capitol building closes, and Micklem, Rizel, and Irene pack up and head back to a hotel. There, they'll rehydrate with fresh vegetable and fruit juice and rest up for the days and weeks ahead. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
Up next, Inside Appalachia, creating tourism opportunities along the Clinch River in Virginia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. These days, so much of the country seems just like everywhere else, the same national chains, the same urban sprawl, and while there are still some authentic regions left, mostly they're far from just about everywhere. As Robbie Harris tells us, that may help folks in Southwest Virginia learn from mistakes others have made and chart their own course for economic development.
The Clinch River in southwestern Virginia is the most biologically diverse in all of North America.
The Clinch is this incredibly special river, more rare species than any river in North America, and yet nobody really knows about it.
Brad Krebs is standing on the banks of the river where it runs through the tiny town of Cleveland, Virginia.
This is one of the most beautiful sections of the river to float. So we're at Nash's Ford on the Clinch River. Absolutely gorgeous. You float through, you know, very remote section of the river, towering cliffs, big green forested slopes. There are stretches of the river where you just feel like you're the only person on earth.
You might think you'd want to keep the secret. After all, how many people give away the location of their favorite fishing or paddling spot? But Krebs is doing that and more. He's the Clinch Valley Program Director for the Nature Conservancy. Working with a host of partners, their goal is to not only protect this unique waterway, but also to spur economic growth in the entire region.
We've had a long history in Southwest Virginia of trying to figure out ways to make conservation not just be good for nature, but also good for people. And the region is challenged economically, so we've always thought about ways in which our work can benefit not just wildlife.
The Conservancy is known for its work preserving wilderness and making it accessible to the public. But the potential for new businesses linked to river and regional recreation is the strategy that's also driving the effort here to introduce this hidden gem to more people. Steve Lindemann is Land Protection Program Manager at the Conservancy.
You know, people aren't going to protect something they don't care about. They're not going to care about something they don't know about. So you got to teach them about it.
The ultimate goal is to create a state park in the Clinch River Valley. working with towns and counties along the river and other nonprofit organizations to acquire real estate from willing landowners. They're slowly stitching together existing hiking trails and creating more access points to the water and woodlands that surround it.
So if folks were staying at the state park, wherever that state park ended up being, some short driving distance from here, or floating distance, you could float here, get out, you know, say you floated a half a day and took a half a day hike on the Pinnacle Natural Preserve. You know, we're not talking about this state park as just a standalone thing. It's a connector, and it's something that can be, it could be a base of operations for somebody.
A $2.5 million line item to fund the creation of a state park in the Clinch River Valley did not make it into the state's final budget agreement passed a few weeks ago. But that's not stopping the push to use nature to nurture economic development in a region that badly needs it. Again, Brad Krebs.
There's so much momentum going. This area is excited and moving forward with ideas around river recreation. We really need the state park, and that's one of the anchor pieces of the whole strategy, but we're not going to stop doing great things on the river.
The mountains of southwestern Virginia were once known for coal mining, manufacturing, and agriculture, and the boom and bust cycles that go with them. Now the region is looking toward more lasting roots to prosperity, using nature and local creative culture to nurture the economy. Robbie Harris continues her report, exploring the Clinch River's role in nurturing economic growth in the region.
You can start here at the waterfall, which is this gorgeous 350-foot waterfall cascading over this mossy limestone cliff, and then hike into the natural area.
Brad Krebs is gazing up at Tank Hollow Falls in the town of Cleveland, Virginia, already envisioning the new hiking trails, which will knit the mountain ridges above into a natural sanctuary for wildlife and people.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And it's just a secret, you know, it's just one of the many little secret treasures, you know, you find in southwest Virginia.
Krebs is Clinch Valley Program Director of the Nature Conservancy. He's working with other nonprofits and communities to leverage the region's indigenous assets into a new engine for economic growth. Something to help replace the declining coal sector and shuttered factories with new industries which are impossible to export.
Southwest Virginia was barely on the radar screen in tourism. We are now, in some cases, leading the state in terms of percentage of increase in visitors, increases in local tax dollars, meals and foods tax.
Jim Baldwin is executive director of the Cumberland Plateau Planning District.
There are numbers that just came out last month that the number of 25 to 40-year-olds is growing in our region. That's a first for a long time.
Baldwin's referring to an economic development report authored by a group called Friends of Southwest Virginia. Based on state, tax, and census data, it cites a steep rise in the percentage of economic growth from local natural and cultural resources.
I think a lot of it has to do with the idea that we're creating economic opportunity while valuing and wanting to protect the assets we have.
According to the report, a 40-year decline in old industries is giving way to a creative economy based on what it calls the region's authentic, distinctive, and alive assets, including natural beauty and outdoor recreation, traditional arts, crafts, and music.
So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night.
The mountains of southwestern Virginia, which divide this region physically and also civically at times, are becoming a unifying front for communities working together to bring new industries based on tourism. There's regional cooperation on the Clinch River Initiative, another called Appalachian Spring, both following the lead of one called the Crooked Road, which highlights the long tradition of mountain music here.
If you want to explain it, like the big bang for that music was the release of O Brother, Where Art Thou? And it completely captured the hearts and ears of young people.
Oh, brothers, let's go down, let's go.
There's something really authentic and distinct about Southwest Virginia.
Again, the Nature Conservancy's Brad Krebs.
So yeah, we have a great chance. chance. You know, we're at the front end and we can learn from all these other examples.
And if it's often been the case that preserving nature and economic development have been at odds, maybe this time, in this place, it will be different. I'm Robbie Harris.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we'll keep on the sunny side of life.
Folks in Southwest Virginia look for ways to tap into nature to develop the economy. A recent event in Hindman, Kentucky, set out to put the Appalachian region on the map as a unique location for American food traditions. WMMT Sylvia Ryerson has this report on the inaugural gathering of the Appalachian Food Summit titled Seeds and Ancestors.
Ronnie Lundy is a renowned Southern food writer and native of Corbin, Kentucky, and was one of the event's lead organizers. As she recalled in welcoming the crowd, while working on her book titled Chuck Beans, Stack Cakes, and Honest Fried Chicken, The Heart and Soul of Southern Country Kitchens, she asked many of her interviewees from Appalachia what their favorite food was growing up. The overwhelming answer? Wilt lettuce. And while today, in other parts of the country,
you know, you might not be able to convince the person in the kitchen that it was a good idea to pour hot bacon grease on little tender greens. But as we all know, it's not only a good idea, it's sacred. So
the day-long summit brought together a diverse crowd of Appalachian farmers, chefs, foragers, food advocates, consumers, and scholars. But everyone, it seemed, shared this sentiment. And as Lundy outlined the goals in bringing everyone together,
we are mostly here to break bread and talk to each other, to find out what we're doing across the Southern Appalachians in terms of food and foodways, and how that can help us not only understand where we are, but stay where we are in a sustainable, growing, beautiful fashion, and move into the future.
Homegrown beans are an essential part of mountain cooking, and many families have passed their seeds down for generations. Bill Best of the Sustainable Mountain Agriculture Project in Berea, Kentucky, has gained global recognition for his practice of heirloom seed saving. And as he shared with the audience,
the way I got started in this was 51 years ago. I was busy planting my first garden, and for the first time in my life, I had ordered seeds from a seed catalog, and I didn't have a clue that the beans would be as bad as they were, or as tough as they were. Product of modern plant breeding, Blue Lakes. And so, in keeping with my tradition of letting the seeds fully fill out the hulls, what we in the mountains call full beans, I let them get full, only to realize that there was no way I could break them. These were no longer snap beans. They were tough as nails. I could very easily have let them dry a little bit and made sandals out of them. Anyhow, I complained bitterly to my mother about my tough beans. And she said, well, I can solve that problem. And so she went to her collection and gave me several varieties of her beans, which were just simply called old-fashioned beans at that time. I don't think they were actually started being called heirlooms until maybe in the 80s when Seed Savers Exchange came into being.
Best passed around small packets of some of his bean seeds from close by.
And this is a beautiful fall bean from not from this general area right here. And I would like to mention that the heirloom beans are most of them named after women, because most of the seed savers were women in my home community. My Aunt Bertie Best bean is known to be over 150 years old.
And for Bill Best, it's much more than just a hobby.
When the modern plant breeders and all the wisdom created a stringless bean, they actually didn't remove the string from the bean. They just spread it out throughout the hull. And that's why beans are so tough now. And that's why you have to eat them while they're young and tender. And the seed companies tell you that eat while young and tender. Do not let lumps appear in your beans. And one that's the seeds. And the protein, you know, in our wisdom, we have created a protein-free bean, just like we have created a lycopene and vitamin-free tomato. And we wonder why we have so many health problems. But I think modern plant breeding is responsible for a large portion of our health problems now, because we just don't have the nutrients in the food. For me, it's a crime against humanity to remove the protein from one of the dominant protein foods throughout the world. And one seed company even advertised its beans as being grass-like. I mean, you had to, while they were just like blades of grass were when you picked them. And I made fun of that in an article that got published a couple of years later. And I said, why grow beans at all? Mow your lawn, put it in the pot. You can have grass-like grass. You don't even have the food with the bean vines.
The day also featured a panel of folks at the forefront of the region's growing local foods movement, including Valerie Horn of Letcher County.
The things that we are trying to do now and promoting now just happened every day in my life as a little girl. In fact, I didn't even know to appreciate it. So I had those things. Sunday visits were at my grandfather's house. We're going to look at his garden. And there were two processing meat plants in Letcher County. I can remember going to as a young girl, and now we're thinking, can we get in touch with the USDA? Can we get in touch with someone? How can we make this happen in Letcher County? We want this.
Valerie Horn works with the Community Farm Alliance, is co-chair of the Letcher County Farmers Market, and coordinates the Grow Appalachia project at the Cowan Community Center, which supports families in growing their own gardens.
This year we have 72 families that we're working with to reduce any barriers to gardening that they might have. The goals are simple: grow more of your own food, and then sell your own food. Make some profit and some income from that. Recently we had 10 families that got microprocessing license, so that will be 10 people who will be able to make it to the farmer's market, sell their items if they'd like. We're trying to give other support through that.
And not only in Letcher County, but across the state, support for local farmers markets is growing rapidly. Sharon Spencer is the farmers market marketing specialist with the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. And as she noted, one indication of their success is that
markets are becoming a permanent home in their community. They're getting funds to build permanent structures, to actually build permanent pavilions. In 2006, we had 34 markets that actually had a permanent home and a park. In this year, we're looking at possibly 70 farmers markets that's going to have a permanent home, someplace that they can go, that they can meet, that they know they're going to be a part of their community.
As of last growing season, of the 120 counties in Kentucky, 101 have their own farmers markets, and many have more than one. Altogether, these markets total $11 million in sales to Kentucky producers. In 2008, the Kentucky legislature designated Kentucky Proud as the official state agriculture marketing program. The label can be given to any farm products that are grown, raised, processed, packaged, or manufactured in the state to help consumers support local producers. And as Spencer outlined, as a part of that,
any veterans that is coming back in, we have a different program as well, along with our Kentucky Proud, but it's called Homegrown by Heroes. That is actually a logo that they can use to put on their products, and it's going to make them stand out. So we're very proud of our veterans and everything that they do, and they put their life on the line for us. So that's just a small token of our appreciation of what we can do back for them.
Mike Lewis is a Kentucky Proud farmer and a veteran himself, and he is also the executive director of Growing Warriors, which works closely with the Homegrown by Heroes program.
And our mission is to equip, assist, and train military veterans in production agriculture. Was how it started. It's been a constant evolution. I guess that's everything in life. But what we've realized really quickly is we're not making farmers. We're making leaders. And, you know, it's been again, just amazing for me to be able to work with these people and to realize that there's a lot of change to be made, but there are a lot of people here to be doing it.
Change, as Ronnie Lundy sees it, will require rethinking what's possible for Eastern Kentucky's economy, and that rebuilding the local food system can be a foundation for this.
We are facing a new economic crisis in Kentucky and West Virginia and parts of Southwest Virginia. The economy that we have relied on for over a century now is vanishing, which would be coal, and we are choosing to embrace this as an opportunity and to say, what can we do now? How can we diversify our economies? What kind of economies can we create that will allow us not only to earn money, but to feed ourselves and take care of our people and continue our traditions? And food is a huge part of this.
And for Bill Best, so many of these stories come back to the beans.
One of the beans that is very popular, was grown by one of my neighbors. It's the goose bean, which is known throughout the Southern Appalachians. When I first asked my mother, how did the goose bean get its name? She said, well, her grandfather, my great-grandfather, was shot and killed a wild goose, and they were found in its craw, and we've raised it since that time. I discovered that that same story had been told to thousands of other kids. But that is the goose bean that is known throughout the Southern Appalachians, the one that is being passed around now.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is the man that feeds them all. If you'll only look and see, I'm sure you will agree that the farmer is the man that feeds them all. Sing it with me. Oh, the farmer is the man. The farmer is the man.
Brett Ratliff of the Hindman Settlement School on fiddle and vocals. For more information on any of the groups at the summit, or work being done to celebrate and strengthen Appalachia's food heritage, look up the Appalachian Food Summit on Facebook. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Sylvia Ryerson in Whitesburg.
Coming up inside Appalachia, we talk to a playwright who hopes his work will shed light on the problems war veterans have. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Appalachia, like other regions of the country, has to address the needs of its veterans who have returned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Kentucky, for instance, more than 18,000 veterans have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, according to Dr. Nicole Luddington of the VA Medical Center in Louisville. They're a part of an estimated 300,000-plus vets nationwide who are suffering from the condition. This year's Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, offers a play that explores how veterans deal with war, PTSD, and sexual assault. Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Charles Fuller's One Night is about two Iraq War veterans who are staying in a seedy hotel trying to make sense of life after the military. Fuller began writing the play in 2008, and as he wrote, he kept track of the Defense Department's sexual assault reports.
And they kept going up. And I thought, my goodness, this is something that no one is talking about. I hadn't heard about it. You know, then I started looking, digging, and I found that lots of women and men as well have been sexually assaulted in the military, and all the branches of the military, the Marines, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, as well as the academies. I think it's a difficult story to tell, really.
Fuller injects a lot of realism into the play based on interviews he's done with veterans who have been victims of sexual assault.
When I look at the people I met, at least, all women. who really had a tough time with this, really a tough, tough time, and are not being treated well. The whole flap about the VA recently is a good example of what is happening to veterans. But the sad part about that is it's the way it's given to us is that all the people are men and not women. And that's just totally crazy. Insane. So, I mean, yes, it's a... I don't know, it's an attempt to do what I think is hard to do. That's... make reality represented on the stage.
Fuller is an Army veteran, and this is not the first play he's written that focuses on the military. In 1982, he won the Pulitzer for A Soldier's Play, a story set in 1944 that deals with murder and race. The play was made into a movie called A Soldier's Story. Fuller says military and civilian life are very different, and he hopes his work will help those who have not served to gain a better understanding of those who have. And he hopes it helps push the public and policymakers to do more for veterans.
There's a line in the play that says, "Why am I a hero if I die and a nuisance if I live?" And that has been the history of veterans in this country since its beginning. People came home from the Civil War with PTSD. I mean, they were called nuts, shell-shocked in the Second World War. I mean, all sorts of things. And while we really praise them while they're dying, once they come home, we tend to lose interest in them. And that's the worst part of it.
In addition to One Night, the theater festival is offering four other plays this season: Uncanny Valley, North of the Boulevard, Dead and Breathing, and Ashes Under Gate City. Each play focuses on a concern or ethical issue of our time. While theatergoers in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, have five contemporary plays to see, opera aficionados in Virginia have the opportunity to hear an opera with an Appalachian twist. Ashlawn Opera in Charlottesville is presenting a performance of Susanna. Sandy Hausman from WVTF Public Radio tells us why that tale is relevant today and how some cast members share their love of the show.
Susanna is a role prized by sopranos like Renee Fleming, who performed it at the Met. Critics described composer Carlisle Floyd as the American Puccini for the passionate lyrics and music he wrote. He tells the story of a beautiful woman who lives in a small town, New Hope Valley, Tennessee. She sings of her longing to leave and make something of her life.
I aim to get out of this valley someday and find out for myself, to see all them tall buildings and all them street lights, and to be one of those folks myself.
That's Michelle Kreisel, general and artistic director for Ashlawn. She loves this opera, and even though she grew up in Los Angeles, she can relate.
I wanted to live in New York. I wanted to live in Paris. I wanted to be one of those folks myself.
The story actually has classic roots in the biblical account of Susanna and the elders.
The elders see her bathing in the creek, which was common. That's what people did. And so they projected their own lust for her on her and thought she was a loose woman. And she was told to go to the church revival and confess her sins. But she had no sins, so she fled.
The preacher follows Susanna home and takes advantage of her, making matters even worse. Kreisel says Floyd did a remarkable job of telling this story from a woman's point of view, and he clearly understood the region where the story was set.
He grew up in the South. His first job as a piano teacher was at Florida State University, and the opera was composed for Florida State University during McCarthyism. So the story really reflects the witch hunt that was felt amongst college intellectuals, where you were accused of a crime you didn't commit, and even if you did commit it, you didn't see it as a crime.
To promote the show, Kreisel scheduled pop-up performances in Charlottesville, and she took some cast members south to the University of Virginia at Wise, where music students took part in a master class.
Oh, may there is in
Kreisel critiqued each student, then invited them to join the show's chorus in a one-time performance that won rave reviews from locals.
The leading lady was absolutely phenomenal, and it gave me chills.
The lead was amazing, the lead's brother on stage was amazing, and the chorus was awesome.
I was intrigued to hear about it and wanted to see an opera brought to life in an Appalachian city.
And adjunct professor Amber Burke says it was a powerful experience for the school's music majors.
I think the students had a really great time. I mean, we learned a square dance in an hour and performed it the next day, and we got to meet a lot of great new people from all over the country, singers and the directors, conductors, and we don't get that very often.
Ashlawn is now rehearsing for performances at the Paramount in Charlottesville on July 11th, 13th, and 16th. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Speaking of theater, up next Inside Appalachia, we'll visit a theater in southern West Virginia that's finding new life. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In southern West Virginia, a nonprofit organization is working to improve the community by renovating an old theater. It's part of the Princeton Renaissance in Mercer County. As Jessica Lilly reports, gutting a theater built more than 100 years ago uncovers interesting pieces of history.
A recent Gallup poll says West Virginia's population is expected to drop by 20,000 through the year 2030. But the same poll shows a majority of West Virginians want to stay. A community is working to keep folks in one Mercer County town by renovating a theater. Community Connections purchased the building and is leading the theater renovation. It's a nonprofit organization that works to prevent drug abuse and better communities with multiple partners. The group also serves as a family resource network for Mercer County. The latest project might seem unconventional, but Executive Director Greg Puckett says renovating an old theater in downtown Princeton just makes sense.
If you continue the environment and you continue just being passive and not doing anything, then people will either give in and do nothing, or they will look elsewhere for those opportunities. And unfortunately, we've been in an area too long where people have looked elsewhere for the opportunities and they've left. Or those that have stayed have been content with what's here. And we simply can't be content anymore.
Community Connections purchased the $85,000 building in August of last year thanks to a donation from the Honeycutt Foundation. Princeton was selected as a blueprint community, which also helped to bring the project to a new level. Entering the hallway from the Mercer Street entrance of the 1911 building is like taking a trip back in time. Originally, Puckett says a jewelry store sat on the left, a doctor's office to the right.
But then on the right side, where the doctor's office was, this is the only existing tin structure really that is left. But because of new fire codes, you know, we do have to take the tin structure down. Unfortunately, because of the damage of the ceiling and everything else, we couldn't really save it. But what we
are going to preserve a piece of history with an artistic twist, Puckett says the tiles will be removed and painted by local artist Richard Shrewsbury and available for purchase. Puckett says he hopes this project makes folks feel connected to the renovation.
That's the main thing that we want people to have a sense of, is that, you know, they have a part in this whole thing. Is it's not a group, it's not an individual. It's really about everybody working together to make this a reality.
Over the past 3 months, volunteers have worked to gut the theater to turn things like the former doctor's office into the theater box office.
Step over into what was originally the jewelry store, and they've had two different jewelry stores in here.
And work is underway to transform the former jewelry store into a museum.
That not only reflects the artistic heritage of Mercer Street, but really Mercer Street itself. So this is going to be a way for us to look back to the past.
Since the theater was known as the Royal Theater when it opened in 1911 and then became the Lavon Theater around 1956, Puckett says the museum will be called the Royal Lavon Museum. The theater itself will be called the Renaissance Theater after the project helping to make it happen, the Princeton Renaissance.
And it's really about that rebirth and that you know, paying attention to the arts and the culture and the history. So I think that it's aptly named, and a lot of the people in the community were the ones that chose the name, so we went with it.
Puckett says he's also hoping to house a unique arcade.
Stuff that's going to be, you know, looking back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, and, you know, so it's going to be, you know, even like whack-a-mole and things like that. It's not the digital age. It's more hands-on. It's more tactile stuff. So we feel that that kind of gets back to the history and still adds a lot of fun.
We'll head in here to the main auditorium. These doors were actually the doors that hung in the theater back in all the way through the 1950s. It's got real nice pane glass. These doors were probably around $4,000 doors. So we want to make sure we try to keep the integrity of these. It's more of an Art Deco style. And then as we move into this area, we've started gutting out which was the foyer. And, of course, you've got your stairwell that goes up to the balcony area.
At one time, 100 seats were reserved for African Americans on the balcony, since only whites were allowed on the floor. Puckett says other pieces of history not necessarily worth cash, like candy wrappers, ticket stubs, and film, were uncovered as workers peeled away layers of walls to remove the boiler and replace the pipes.
Back on this back wall, when we started gutting out, we discovered one of the original planters that they had for sort of like a deco style in here is still left on the wall. So they would put some fake flowers in that, and you can see the original design that had come up through the theater with the, you know, the little Omega piece there.
Puckett also found what appears to be a sketch by an architect that laid out plans for the 1950s renovation, and even the silver screen, which was painted blue, was found crumpled on the floor.
And when you're pulling film and you're pulling things of where the projectors had sat, it gives you that sense of nostalgia, and it makes you feel like you're on an American Pickers episode. I mean, you're going through and you're finding all these really cool things that to the common individual, you know, they'd look at it and go, oh, it's a ticket stub, and they throw it away. But when you know you're holding a ticket stub that's probably 75 to 80 years old, and that somebody took that stub, they came in, they got it torn by a doorman at the, you know, at the door when they're walking through, they probably picked up some popcorn, they probably did all those things, and you know that you're holding a piece of the history that somebody else had 75, 80 years ago. That's important.
Puckett says reminding us of our past is a good way to look into the future.
Signal that, you know, we're working on not even our generation, we're working on the generation to come. We want people to come downtown. We want people to feel engaged in what they're doing. And I think by doing these little things and taking everything with significance and importance is really what's going to make this whole place be better for the entire county, not just for Princeton, not just for Mercer Street, but for everybody involved. This is a step in the right direction.
Puckett says when complete, the theater will be open to the community for events. In an effort to attract families, Puckett says no R-rated movies will play at the Renaissance Theater. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Princeton.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WVTF in Southwestern Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.